Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU.
This week, Apple blames Spotify for €1.8 billion fine. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
On this week's show, Apple's €1.8 billion fine from the EU for forcing rivals to its Apple Music streaming service to stay quiet about cheaper subscriptions in their iOS apps. And Live Nation's claim that it's everyone else in the music industry forcing up the price of tickets. But first, Chris, tell me one more interesting thing that happened in the music industry this week.
Well, there was an update from Tidal.
It's good to be reminded that Tidal exists.
Exactly. So it's always good when there's an update from Tidal. Yes, it still exists as a streaming service. But the update was quite interesting in that it's kind of an end of an era, because basically what Tidal announced this week is that they are phasing out their super premium subscription tier, their $19.99 tier, and what you get with the $19.99 tier at the moment that you don't get with their standard $10.99 tier is the super duper high quality audio and the immersive audio, the spatial audio. At the moment with Tidal, you still have to pay extra to get all of that. They're getting rid of that. So basically, there won't be a $19.99 version of Tidal, and the higher quality audio that's currently only available at the higher price will become available on the $10.99 subscription. Now, people who pay attention to streaming service subscription packages might say, well, why is that news? Because Apple, Amazon and others, they basically already do that. All the high quality audio, the immersive audio, is just part of the standard package. But I think why it's interesting is Tidal were the innovators when it came to the idea of offering high quality audio. They were still called WIMP at the time. They sensibly rebranded once they moved into English-speaking markets. And it was Tidal / WIMP that first had this idea of, well, what if we were to offer higher quality audio at a higher price? Because, of course, streaming is a revenue share business. So if a certain portion of the subscribers pay double initially in order to access the higher quality audio, then that's more money for the industry to share in. It basically increases the average spend per average user. So that's what Tidal pioneered, and then Deezer and Amazon and others followed suit. But it was Apple that decided, when it added higher quality audio, no, we're just going to make it part of the standard subscription, because of course Apple really wants higher quality audio in there so it can sell you expensive headphones and such like. So Apple changed the system, Amazon then put higher quality audio into its standard package. Tidal was already offering higher quality audio as part of its $10.99 package. If we were to compare the audio available on the standard Tidal subscription with the audio quality on the standard Spotify subscription, but the super high quality and the spatial was reserved for the higher priced package. That is changing. So it's kind of the end of the idea. I mean, Apple basically killed this a few years ago, but it's the official end of this idea that maybe the music industry could get more out of the average subscriber by having at least a portion of the subscribers paying an additional amount of money every month in order to get the super high quality audio. That idea has gone. We now have to offer all of the high quality audio, including spatial audio, as part of the standard package, unless, of course, you're Spotify.
Yes, in which case, nothing. Don't offer anything high quality, just standard rubbish.
Spotify, of course.
Is that what Spotify say?
I'm not sure that's the wording they use in their marketing. Spotify has promised numerous times that it was also going to start offering the higher quality audio. They even announced what it was going to be called. It was going to be called Spotify Hi-Fi. They were indicating, even as recently as, oh, well, I say that. A few years ago, they were indicating that Spotify Hi-Fi would be at a higher price. There were then rumours last year that finally Spotify Hi-Fi was coming, and indeed, it would be at a higher price. But as of today, Spotify is still only making music available basically at the highest quality MP3 format rather than at a FLAC or high-res FLAC or spatial. And so, if you're a Spotify user, however much money you're willing to pay, you can't get it at high quality audio. It remains to be seen whether Spotify ever makes good on its promises to offer the high quality audio at some point. And if it does, if it chooses to charge extra for it, even though, as of today, everybody else is just providing it as standard.
Yes, we will see. And I mean, I suppose, well, Spotify remains the dominant streaming service, so it possibly proves that no one actually cares about high quality audio, so it's not worth trying to charge for it, as possibly Tidal has now discovered.
It has always felt like the high quality audio, although lots of people in the music industry like it, is a little bit of a niche product. Some people think that maybe spatial audio, particularly once things like Apple's Vision Pro becomes much more widely used, maybe there will be a wider audience for the spatial audio, the immersive audio. But yeah, at the moment, it does kind of feel like most people signing up to a streaming service don't really care what quality audio. Well, obviously, they would care if it was really, really shit. But yeah, providing it's kind of what they became used to in the early days of digital, then they're happy. And we don't care either. So we're not going to talk about high quality audio or Tidal on this edition of Setlist. I just thought I would mention it because, you know, it's always nice to give Tidal a little mention just so everybody remembers that they do still exist.
Yes, but let's get on with what they're actually here to talk about, because later on we're going to be discussing more of this week's most interesting music industry news stories, including the news that millennials are driving the growth of paid-for streaming services, but are also the most likely to be considering cancelling their subscriptions. But first, the European Union has fined Apple more than 1.8 billion euros for abusing its dominant position in relation to the distribution of music streaming services for iOS devices. That fine is nearly four times bigger than initially rumoured, and it's the third biggest fine that the EU has ever imposed in relation to a breach of competition law, and it's the outcome of an investigation that was kickstarted by a complaint from Spotify over Apple's App Store rules relating to in-app payments. Apple, unsurprisingly, was not particularly happy about the ruling and said that regulators at the European Commission had come to their conclusion in the investigation despite being unable to uncover any credible evidence of consumer harm. Their ruling, Apple said, ignores the realities of a market that is thriving, competitive, and growing fast. But Spotify, the original complainant, on the other hand, said that this decision sends a powerful message. No company, not even a monopoly like Apple, can wield power abusively to control how other companies interact with their customers. And Deezer, also getting in on the act, said that it is very positive to see that the EU is taking action against Apple and is showing readiness to firmly sanction anti-competitive practices.
So maybe let's do a little bit of background on this story. Spotify and other app developers, including, as you just said, Deezer, have long criticised Apple's App Store rule that forces many app developers to take in-app payments on iOS devices via Apple's own commission charging transaction system. They also oppose another App Store rule, what is often referred to as the anti-steering provision, or the anti-steering rule, which is basically a rule that says an app developer can't, within their app, say to the user, if you want to make a payment, if you want to buy a subscription, if you want to spend some money with us, don't do it within the app, because if we do it within the app, we're going to have to use Apple's system and we'll have to pay them a commission and we don't want to. But click this button, click this link, take you to a page on our website, to somewhere elsewhere online, do the payment there so we can cut Apple out. So those are the two rules that Spotify and lots of other app developers have opposed over the years. And some app developers have gone legal on this, filing litigation. But others, like Spotify, instead have gone to competition regulators and said, we feel that these rules are anti-competitive, a violation of competition law. When Spotify started complaining about this to the European Union and European Commission in the mid-2010s, and when they filed a formal complaint with the EC competition regulator in 2019, they were moaning about both of those rules, although ultimately it was the anti-steering provision that became the focus of the EC's investigation. And in its statement this week, the competition regulators of the European Union said, the Commission's investigation found that Apple bans music streaming app developers from fully informing iOS users about alternative and cheaper music subscription services available outside of the app and from providing any instructions about how to subscribe to such offers.
So given that Apple's initial commission on in-app payments would basically wipe out Spotify's profit margin, the streaming service has two choices under the existing rules. Either it increases its prices on iOS devices so that it passes Apple's commission onto the customer, which makes Spotify look more expensive than Apple Music, even though you could go and get it for the same price if you went to Spotify's website. Or the other option is to just not allow people to sign up within the iOS app, which negatively impacts the user experience, because you also can't tell people that they can subscribe outside of the app. So it just makes it confusing. Spotify did initially pass that commission on and charged $12.99 a month instead of $9.99, but then later just stopped selling premium subscriptions in its iOS app altogether. Commenting further on these rules in its decision, the EU said that these anti-steering provisions are neither necessary nor proportionate for the protection of Apple's commercial interests in relation to the App Store on Apple's smart mobile devices, and negatively affects the interests of iOS users who cannot make informed and effective decisions on where and how to purchase music streaming subscriptions for use on their device. And in calculating this €1.8 billion fine, the regulators said they took into account the duration and gravity of the infringement and the fact that Apple submitted incorrect information in the framework of the administrative procedure. But perhaps most importantly, it considered how huge Apple is, its huge turnover and its market capitalization, which means that it had to impose a really big fine if it was to be any deterrent at all.
Yeah, basically, Apple has an awful lot of money. In fact, even with the €1.8 billion that it has been fined by the regulators in the European Union, that is still around about, by our maths, 1.36% of Apple's current assets, what are sometimes referred to as Apple's cash pile. So the tech giant's current assets are around about $143.5 billion, which means €1.8 billion. Obviously, it will be more in dollars, but it's still a relatively small part of the assets Apple is sitting on. Nevertheless, Apple is not just going to hand over this money without fighting. It will appeal the ruling, it will appeal the fine, and that's likely to then result in years of litigation, this investigation having already taken years to get to this point. Although in a way, for Spotify, the fine isn't the important bit. I mean, it's funny. If you're Daniel Ek, the boss of Spotify, or part of the top team at Spotify, it's funny to see one of your main competitors being fined so much money. But more important for Spotify is the order that has been issued by the European Commission within the European Union alongside the fine, basically telling Apple that it has to change its App Store rules around the anti-steering provision. And ultimately, that is what Spotify wants to see happen. That said, it does remain to be seen quite how Apple chooses to comply with that order, because technically, under a thing called the Digital Markets Act in the European Union, which has relatively recently come fully into force, under those regulations within the EU, Apple has already been forced to change its anti-steering provision. So you could say that all this order from the EU is doing is replicating what is already now part of European law. Except that the way Apple has announced that it is going to comply with the Digital Markets Act, or the DMA, has been hugely criticised by Spotify and others, because basically the argument is Apple has chosen to comply with the DMA in a way that introduces new hurdles for app developers. So actually, even though Apple will claim that it is compliant with European law, app developers are no better off. And so, of course, what Spotify needs to ensure is that Apple doesn't do exactly the same when complying with this order.
Now back to Apple's statement following the announcement of the fine, which, I mean, to be honest, mainly just laid into Spotify, although it did find time to badmouth the European regulators as well. I mean, particularly it moaned about how friendly Swedish streaming company Spotify had become with European Commission officials after its first complaint about the App Store way back in 2015. And it kind of implied that Europeans just love nothing more than ganging up on poor little defenseless American corporations like Apple that struggle to stand up against giants like Spotify on their home turf. I mean, not that Apple doesn't employ a lot of lobbyists in the EU to protect its interests, just clearly they didn't help on this occasion, because none of those lobbyists have helped Apple in its bid to convince the officials that Spotify's complaints about anti-competitive behaviour were nonsense. And Apple said, European consumers have more choices than ever in a digital market that's grown exponentially. In just 8 years, it's gone from 25 million subscribers to almost 160 million, with more than 300 million active listeners. And Spotify has been the biggest winner. So, whatever Spotify tells you, Apple says, there is no evidence of consumer harm caused by its App Store rules. And it adds, 8 years of investigation have never yielded a viable theory explaining how Apple has thwarted competition in a market that is so clearly thriving. That means that there is also no evidence of anti-competitive behaviour. Spotify, it goes on, just wants to rewrite the rules of the App Store in a way that advantages them even more. They want to use Apple's tools and technologies, distribute on the App Store, and benefit from the trust we've built with users, and to pay Apple nothing for it.
Yeah, Apple's statement also listed in quite some detail all the ways in which Spotify have utilised Apple's technology and Apple's platform and all the work that Apple has done to help Spotify build this brilliant app and this brilliant business. And I guess, you know, it is true that Spotify has majorly benefited from the infrastructure that Apple has built in order to have an app on iOS devices. Those of you with very long memories may remember that when Spotify first launched, you could only use it on your desktop computer. It kind of seems mad now, doesn't it, that that was the service. It's definitely true that being able to offer compelling music experiences on smartphones like iPhones is what helped take Spotify and its competitors truly to the mainstream and to become such a big business. So on one level, it is true. Spotify has benefited from Apple's technology and Apple's investments, and maybe it should be more grateful for that. Although then the flip side is, Apple did make apps and the App Store a really central part of its smart devices, of the iPhone. And once it had decided that these devices were going to be all about the apps, it then really needed companies like Spotify to embrace that and to build really good experiences that people can use. So I think, you know, one of the reasons why iPhones are such good devices is because of the apps developed by the Spotify's of this world. So Spotify could say, yeah, okay, we benefited from your infrastructure, we benefited from your investment, but your devices benefit from us making our brilliant service available to iOS users, to iPhone owners. So maybe it balances out.
As we noted, for Spotify, the most important part of the ruling is not the fine. It's the order for Apple to change its rules around the signposting of alternative payment options. But to what extent that will really help depends on how Apple chooses to comply with it. If it proposes to comply with the order in the same way it's proposed to comply with the Digital Markets Act, then Spotify is not going to be happy with that. It's already not happy and will presumably want European officials to intervene and make Apple implement this order in a way that it is happy with. And Spotify noted that in its response to the ruling, saying, while we appreciate the European Commission addressing this important case, we also know that the details matter. Apple has routinely defied laws and court decisions in other markets, so we're looking forward to the next steps that will hopefully clearly and conclusively address Apple's long-standing unfair practices.
Yeah, and although this story has generally been spun very much as an Apple versus Spotify battle, as we've already mentioned, it also impacts on many, many, many other app developers, including Deezer. And in fact, when it comes to how Apple is implementing the Digital Markets Act, a letter was put out recently signed by a whole load of app developers, Spotify, Deezer, but also lots of app developers that are not in the music space, basically saying what Spotify is saying, which is the way you've complied with Digital Markets Act, that's a nonsense. And they will also be saying, in order to comply with this European Commission ruling, no sneaky tricks. You need to comply in a way that benefits all of the app developers. As we mentioned, Deezer also put out a statement in response to the news of the big fine, saying it's a positive development, etc., etc. But it added, Apple's response to the Digital Markets Act is fundamentally deceptive and an attempt to bypass European regulations. So Deezer also saying, like Spotify, the devil is in the detail. The order to change the App Store rules is good, but it's basically just doing what the Digital Markets Act is already doing. Apple has tried to sneak around those new obligations. Will we see the European regulators stand up and say, not only do we want 1.8 billion euros of your money, but you've got to comply with this order in a very specific way so that Spotify and Deezer, maybe they're not completely happy, but they're slightly less pissed off than they currently are. We'll see how this all turns out.
Coming up later, Live Nation's insistence that it has absolutely nothing to do with rising ticket prices. But before that, let's briefly look at some other stories from the music industry this week, starting with Warner Music Group, which has confirmed that it approached independent distributor Believe last month to propose a possible acquisition. That approach comes as Believe CEO Denis Ladegallieri is leading his own bid to take the company back into private ownership.
There was another development this week in the ongoing Hypnosis v Hypnosis saga, which we haven't really discussed much on Setlist so far. I actually think it probably needs its own entire podcast series because there have been so many twists and turns in this story. But the development this week was that the publicly listed Hypnosis Songs Fund announced that it had revalued the catalogue of music rights that it owns, and the new valuation is 26.3% lower than the previous valuation. That's a pretty big cutback. It had quite a big impact on the share price of the Hypnosis Song Fund. And this is all part of the ongoing war of words between the Hypnosis Song Fund and another company called Hypnosis Song Management, which is basically the investment advisor for the fund. It also manages the fund's catalogues and the relationship between the two Hypnosis entities. Well, they've become slightly tense, and that was the latest development in that story.
More US politicians are trying to get TikTok banned in the country over data security concerns caused by the app being owned by China-based ByteDance. A new bill proposed in Congress this week orders ByteDance to sell the app or face a US-wide ban.
ERA, which is the UK Organisation for Entertainment Retailers and Streaming Services, published its 2024 yearbook, which maps entertainment retail and consumption trends during 2023. And among many other things, it shows that millennials are the generation most likely to have a paid-for streaming music subscription. So 36.1% of the millennials surveyed by ERA saying, yeah, we pay to stream entertainment, so music. It may also be a sort of Netflix-type subscription. But not only are millennials most likely to pay to subscribe, they're also most likely to cancel their subscriptions. So 33% said that they intended to cut back on just how many subscriptions they have. Now, whether or not that will impact on the music services, maybe it would impact more on the video services, because obviously, generally with music, most people have one subscription, say Spotify or Apple or whatever, whereas on the video side, you're more likely to have a Netflix and an Amazon and a Disney subscription at the same time. So maybe the cancellations will affect the video side more. But either way, those millennials very keen on subscription streaming, but also quite keen to cancel.
And at last weekend's Brit Awards, Ray took home 6 of the 7 awards that she was nominated for, including Artist and Album of the Year. That is the most Brit Awards won in a single night by a female artist ever. And she also equaled the overall record held jointly by David Bowie, Michael Jackson and Oasis. And that's quite a dramatic conclusion to, I guess, the latest phase of her career, because she does that as an independent artist. Having previously been signed to Universal's Polydor label, and she got out of that deal after complaining that after 5 years of being signed to the label to a 4-album deal, she still hadn't been allowed to release an album, despite writing plenty of what she saw as hits, and indeed was vindicated when she was released from the deal and released an album independently. It was very successful, and now it's won her a lot of Brit Awards.
Yeah, the cynic in me wonders, of the 1,000-odd people who vote for the Brit Awards, How many were motivated by Ray's album being a great album? I think that definitely was a key part of it. But also, when you're doing your voting, were some of those people thinking, I get to vote for an artist who I rate, I get to vote for an album that I like, but it's also a bit of a fuck you to Universal Music. Now, presumably, the voters who work at Universal Music wouldn't feel that way. I don't know, maybe some of them do, but... Maybe some of the Brit Academy voters were thinking, yeah, that would be funny on the night. I also like the record. She's getting my vote. I don't know.
You can read more about all of these stories and everything discussed on this week's episode in the show notes or at completemusicupdate.com. And finally, on this edition of Setlist, Live Nation has published a blog post hitting out at the allegation that the market dominance of the Live Giant and its ticketing division, Ticketmaster, is responsible for high ticket prices. Promoters and ticketing companies are not responsible for ticket pricing, it insists. It's all the fault of venues, artists, and secondary ticketing platforms. Though, probably not the Live Nation managed venues, artists, and secondary ticketing platforms.
Presumably not. So the ticketing business remains in the political spotlight in the US. Various grievances have been raised about the way ticketing works, some of which results in specific criticism of Live Nation and Ticketmaster, and sometimes even the 2010 merger that brought those two companies into one business. In this blog post, which was written by Live Nation's EVP Corporate and Regulatory Affairs, Dan Wall, he writes, in the ongoing antitrust attacks on Live Nation and Ticketmaster, a consistent theme is that their alleged monopolies are responsible for high ticket prices. Rhetorically, that's understandable, because if you want to rile up fans against Live Nation and Ticketmaster, there is no better way than to blame them for something you know fans dislike. However, he said, statements to the effect that Live Nation and Ticketmaster keep ticket prices high are just flat wrong. Anyone with a basic understanding of the industry, I'm hoping that's pretty much everybody listening to Setlist, but you know, anybody with a basic understanding of the industry knows this. Those who perpetuate this falsehood are cynical at best. They do a disservice to consumers and to rational political discourse.
Now, the intention of this blog post is clear in the context of the ongoing political debate around ticketing in the US and Live Nation's efforts to steer that debate to the specific issues which, if addressed, will have the least impact on its business. Although it is also true that some of the criticism of the ticketing business in general, or Live Nation and Ticketmaster in particular, is based on a misunderstanding of how the live music sector works. And to that end, Wall's blog post sets out the respective roles of artists, management, promoters, venues, and ticket agents in the planning and delivery of tours. Among other things, he insists that it's unfair to describe the fees added to a ticket purchase as junk fees, which is the term that US President Joe Biden particularly liked to use when talking about these. Wall says, service charges are added to the face value of concert tickets because two important players in the concert ecosystem, venues and primary ticketing companies, get little or nothing out of the revenues derived from the ticket's face value. Now, of course, some criticism of the service fees actually relates to the industry practice of listing them separately to the ticket price, especially if those extra costs are only declared late on in the transaction. And Live Nation does support all-in pricing, which is where the full cost of the ticket is declared upfront in marketing and on ticketing websites. But Wall's point is that even if the industry was to fully hide the extra service fees from the consumer, so bundle them in with everything else and make it just one flat ticket price, those fees would still need to be charged because that's how the venues and ticketing companies get paid.
As for who dictates pricing, Wall insists in his blog post that while promoters and ticketing companies obviously have to cover their costs and obviously want a profit margin, it's actually artists and venues who have more influence when setting ticket prices and service fees. The argument being artists and their teams, their agent and management really control ticket prices, and it's the venues in partnership with the ticketing companies that control the service fees. He wrote, tickets are actually priced by artists and their teams. It's their show. They get to decide what it costs to get in. Meanwhile, the venue decides on the service fees. Not only that, he was keen to stress, Of the ticket price money, most of it goes to the artist. And of the service fee, he reckons, most of it ends up with the venue, not the ticketing company.
Now, I did note that Live Nation also has artist and venue management divisions. And I guess remembering that, Wall, therefore, didn't want to outright blame artists and venues for any increase in ticket prices, especially around the biggest tours and shows. He said that other economic factors are the cause. Concerts, he said, have become premier experience goods, which increases production costs. And for the biggest acts who sell out every show, it's mainly the result of supply and demand. High demand will push up the price, especially when artists see tickets going for ever higher prices on secondary ticketing sites, so that it's touts who benefit if tickets are underpriced.
So it's all the fault of the ticket touts, or ticket scalpers if you're American, and the websites they use to resell tickets. Although you also noted at the start of this section, not only does Live Nation have artist and venue management divisions, as well as being a tour promoter and having a ticketing company, in the US, it also still runs a bunch of secondary ticketing websites. So it's also involved in ticket resale. So can we blame the touts? Can we blame the tout sites? It does have to be said, in the last year, with the political debate around ticketing in the US and whether or not there should be new laws and new regulations, generally it does seem at the moment that Live Nation would be more willing to accept extra regulation when it comes to ticket resale, even though it is still involved in ticket resale in the US, if that means that there's no new regulation on its core tour promotions and ticketing business. So it is generally the case at the moment that Live Nation are a little more willing to be a little bit critical of secondary ticketing, even though they're involved in it. Although Dan Wall did find one other group of people to blame for increased ticket prices that will allow all of the different divisions of Live Nation off the hook. Basically, it's the fault of record labels and streaming services because, he concluded towards the end of his blog post, another key factor to take into account is that touring has become a much more important revenue stream for artists over the last 20 years, because when the record industry collapsed in the 2000s with the shift to digital, there was less money coming through the record industry for artists. Labels were less willing to invest in tours, seeing tours as a useful way of promoting albums and then selling the records. So it's all the fault of the record industry and the streaming services. Artists need more money from the live side of their business, and that is one of the reasons why, where an artist sees big demand for their tickets and they see the kind of money that fans are spending on the touting platforms for those tickets, they inevitably think, do you know what, on my next tour, I'm just going to put the prices up.
So make what you will of that. We will link through to the full blog post if you want to read that. But that's all we've got time for on this week's setlist. We'll be back with another episode next week, and you can keep up with all the latest music industry news every day at completemusicupdate.com.